Victor Wembanyama is unimpressed and did not impress at Madison Square Garden. Who should push the panic button, the Kings or the King? And we've got several hot takes. All that and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. And joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it is my man, your man, everyone's man, Dan Devine. What's up?
The top of Victor Wembanyama's head and hands, I imagine. I didn't get to get a close look at him, but you did, Jake Fisher. You were at Madison Square Garden, the world's most famous arena, which Victor Wembanyama said was not as big as he thought. Maybe he thinks it's a little bit bigger now after what the Knicks just did to him. But I guess, I don't know. We'll find out as we go along here. NC Armada, I'm going to try to address you every week as we get going. We're going on an adventure. Come with us.
We're going on an adventure around the league. First, we will do some quick hitting news and notes. Robert Williams, season-ending surgery, likely could be a couple months. We'll see how his body responds to going under the knife. But my real only thought on this, because look, nice piece that I know the Blazers were happy to receive back for Jrue Holiday to add to their return for Damian Lillard. However, I think the most interesting piece of this, not to like trivialize it, folks in Boston got to be maybe saying, I told you so, or patting themselves on the back like a little bit. I think his tendency to be a little injury prone dating back to his college days was something that just wasn't part of the tenable long-term, let's make this team even better of a contender plans. And you can look at Al Horford and Kristaps Porzingis' injury questionable, you know, dossiers themselves, but think Robert's undependability, unavailability was like kind of a driving factor of their trade deadline talks last February when they were trying to look into the Jakob Poeltl sweepstakes and other things. So it's just that was my first takeaway, Dan. Any quick hitting thoughts on your side of things?
Yeah, the scary part is that it's the other knee, right? Like the injury that he'd had in Boston when he tore his meniscus in his left knee down the stretch of the 2022 season, played through that in the playoffs, needed surgery on it, missed the beginning of last season. This is the other knee. So got a guy who just turned 26. His game is really predicated on his athleticism, his vertical spacer, his quickness, his shot blocking, all that stuff. Now he's, you know, multiple knee surgeries before, you know, when he just turned 26. It's a dangerous situation. It's something that you have to be concerned about there. From Portland's perspective, yeah, you know, you'd imagine they would have liked to have had the opportunity to maybe flip him again as another, you know, to continue to expand the return. You know, I think a lot of people were connecting the dots when the Steven Adams news happened, like, oh, he would make a ton of sense in Memphis. They go get Bismack Biyombo. Now Portland is not going to be able to move Robert Williams in all likelihood. And, you know, Malcolm Brogdon's hurt there. So how much they expand that trade is going to be interesting to see what they do. But the biggest thing is just, yeah, you hope that this is something that he's going to be able to come back from. And then what kind of piece does he look like? What kind of player does he look like on those two surgically repaired knees moving forward? But, you know, best wishes for a healthy recovery for the Time Lord.
Best wishes, Time Lord. Really quickly, this is not in the rundown, but you said Bismack Biyombo, and it just made me think. I literally was talking about this with someone last night. It is wild how Bismack Biyombo changed the course of the Phoenix Suns history, and I'll say it. I'll explain it very, very briefly.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Two things. One, just signing him off the street, essentially, whenever he joined Phoenix. I forget what year it was because all the seasons post-COVID are jumbled in my brain.
Right.
It both, at one point, allowed the Suns to think, by all accounts, well, if Chris Paul can do this with this guy, then like, why do we need to pay $33 million to DeAndre Ayton?
Jake, can I blow your mind real quick? That was last year. That like just happened.
Wow. That was this January 2023 or
so? Actually, so I'm sorry. Sorry. I was looking. You know what happened? I looked at Basketball Reference and I saw P-H-O under C-H-O. So I was wrong. I transposed one. It was two seasons ago, 2021.
Two seasons ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then also like, looking at the Chris Paul blah 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 dynamic. Well, then as things started to get changing, like not needing him, and maybe we don't need Chris Paul anymore either. Like that type of stuff was just it's funny. So from one Western Conference contender to another, Denver, the contender being Phoenix, Denver, Jamal, and on the injury front as well, Jamal Murray, unfortunately out likely a month with a hamstring injury, which, I mean, hamstring injuries ain't fun, man. So shout out, I guess, rooting for Jamal to get back on the court as speedy as he can, because Denver's still chugging along 8-1 after a victory over the Warriors last night, which we'll touch on later in the show. But yeah, as Tom Haberstroh said on Divine Intervention, if you missed that episode, maybe this could further boost Jokic's MVP chances. My thoughts are, because and just talking to some people this week, and when Denver has come up, people around the league have been wanting to notice and observe how these rookies and Denver's bench actually can flourish over these next 50 games or so. Because like Christian Brown has proven himself, but there really is no understanding of what Peyton Watson or Colin Gillespie or Julian Strother can actually do when a reigning NBA champion is competing with their back against the wall in the postseason. So, or even just play NBA legitimate rotation minutes. So I think maybe that's a silver lining of Jamal being out. It's going to mean a lot more Reggie Jackson minutes. But to me, like, the biggest thought I have is, how much more do we see of this younger bench unit that Calvin Booth and his front office are so confident in? And will it potentially lead to them having to go acquire some type of veteran plug and play addition come February?
Yeah, the reason that I imagine that Booth and company are so confident is because they have to feel like they're going to be able to field an elite offense as long as Jokic is on the floor, kind of no matter who else is entering the ball to him.
For sure.
And I mean, the early returns, as you would expect, are pretty promising there. They're plus 19.5 per 100 possessions with Murray off the floor this season. They looked really good on offense for much of last night against Golden State, even with, yeah, as you mentioned, Reggie Jackson goes into the starting lineup. Colin Gillespie becomes the primary backup point guard. One thing that I found interesting to watch there is just Aaron Gordon's touches, I think, are going to go up a lot, because he's now like, him grabbing the ball off the rim and pushing in transition is going to be, I imagine, an even bigger part of their menu. And he was just going to carry, he's going to bring the ball up the court more. Like, he's going to be somebody that takes the inbounds pass and brings it up, because they have so much trust in him and he's got so much freedom to play now. So what does that do for the geometry of an offense? It's already about trying to be bigger and stronger than you. If the ball handler is also doing that a lot more, like maybe 4 or 5 pick and roll and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see what that looks like. But yeah, they're going to give these young guys a chance. They believe they can play. And the hope, I guess the other silver lining, glass half full, is like, if Jamal Murray gets, you know, is rested and ready, you know, in a month and a half, comes back and he's able to carry an even bigger load as some of the other guys kind of hit the doldrums of the season.
Last quick hitter before we get into the spectacle that was at MSG last night. LeBron versus Dylan Brooks. Dylan Brooks is good at marketing. Dylan Brooks at shoot around, I believe it was the day before or the day of, I think it was the day before, telling reporters who asked about his first matchup post the debacle, I'll call it, of Dylan Brooks's versus LeBron series
that, yeah,
against the Lakers that truly cemented his exit from Memphis. That did also net him 4 years, $80 million from Houston. He backed it up, man. But before even just the backed it up part, and the stare down on the court that I saw Kelly Iko record and blast to the interwebs. Bless you, Kelly Iko. Eco, I'm sorry. Kelly Eco. Ecosystem. Kelly
Eco. That's right. That's the way to remember it. The column's called the ecosystem. It's pretty good.
I always say Iko in my head, but shout out Kelly. Kelly knows he's a real one. So I just think in all the talk of the in-season tournament stuff and the new TV deal and coming up and what have you, we need more of this. I don't want to keep going to a shoot around. This is not a personal vendetta, as it could sound. I don't want to keep going to a shoot around at one of the colleges in Midtown or one of the arenas here, or when I go on the road, like when I went to Milwaukee. This is not a shot at the Sixers. Like, there's just a couple players hanging around the court for the season opener. Like, it's the season opener, and like no one wanted to talk, which, if you want to sell this product, if you want people tuning in to regular season games, get me hyped up for this random matchup on a Wednesday night that I have 7 other games to not watch that over for, or like anything else to do in my life. I'm talking to the average layperson who is a right, theoretical consumer of this product.
You are, if nothing else, the people's insider. You are speaking for the people right now.
I am speaking for the people. We need more of this. give me the trash talking, or not even that. Just some, even like Victor saying, "Oh, I thought MSG wasn't so big." Like, he'd even say it with a tone at all. Right. He was more, it was like a humbled, like, assessment of, "Oh, I'm supposed to be, but this is just another stadium in terms of like size and stage and what have you." I think after the event took place and the pregame spectacle that we can talk about in a second, whatever, we need people, we need these players and the coaches and truly everyone involved, I think, like, all on board in making this the reality TV show that it actually is. And shout out Dylan Brooks. I've been saying it since Manila. I'm in on the villain. Give me the villain. LeBron scored 18 points in 27 minutes, pretty efficient, but the Houston run by 34. So I'm giving it to Mr. Brooks, and we'll talk more about the Lakers later. Dan, I'm shipping it over to you.
Sorry, one quick thing. Yes, Dylan Brooks is good at marketing. He's also good at basketball. And I think the way that last season ended led people to forget about that. It is worth noting that the Houston Rockets are like pretty good, decent. I think top 10 in both on both ends of the ball right now. Dylan Brooks is averaging about 15 points a game, shooting 57% from the floor. They're outscoring teams by 15 points per 100 with him on the floor. Like, he's good. And I like when guys talk. I think you're absolutely right. The more we get to know these people as people, even if the kind of person they are is abrasive, and maybe even especially if the kind of person they are is abrasive, I think that's to the net good for all of it. Give us people to root for, people to root against, and an actual glimpse of who these guys are. And then they go and they ball out, so much the better.
A person everyone's rooting for is obviously Victor Wembanyama. And so the most important thing I can report, I did not get a chance to ask him if he liked the Wemby nickname, but I do know that people on the Spurs simply referred to him as V. So
V,
that's like the new shorthand, like, people, you know, if you're in the inner sanctum, you call LeBron Braun. So
sure, this,
I'm going to be keeping an eye out for who calls him Victor, who calls him V, who calls him Wemby, to show what type of badge you're carrying in.
It's good. The NBA needs a different V, because the last V we had was V Stiviano, and I don't think anybody needs to be going back to that. Unless V wants to go to the full face shield, which I'd be on board with. You know, you need a very large face shield for Victor Wembanyama, I imagine. Like, the entirety of my camera shot.
Yeah, well, he took Madison Square Garden and didn't look great. 126-105 Knicks over Spurs. Spurs now 3-5, three straight losses. Victor was 0-5 in the first half, 0-3 from three. It was tough. A lot of double teams, a lot of pressure from Tom Thibodeau's gritty and grimy defense. John, our producer, said I wrote a beautiful piece. So thank you, John.
That's a very nice compliment.
Highlighting that Wemby is young, but mentally ready for these challenges. And
sorry, Jake, if you could please call him V, I'd appreciate that.
I don't know him that way, so I need to.
I don't know him like that. I can't call him V.
I need to earn V. I need to be able to earn it one day. One day. I mean, I was told by some folks that I need to make a trip down to San Antonio, and I'll be shown some Southern hospitality. So I'm going to make that happen at some point this year. It does sound nice. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely got there and posted up on the sideline pretty equidistant with the rim. Not equidistant. What's the word? Even level. I was sitting parallel with the rim.
Parallel. There we go. All right.
Because I've seen Steph Curry at the peak of the Golden State, you know, traveling circus that was for a while. And the Garden does this thing more so than I've seen at other stadiums, where they give out pregame passes, it's called, and like got people sitting like the first four rows, and the people are out. They were out in full force with their cameras and their TikToks and their videos. I took some videos begrudgingly because our employers have asked us to do that. But what?
I mean, it's not, I think it would be, whether the employers begrudgingly asked it or not, when you see something like that close, I imagine that you would have to take a picture of it or a video of it, right? Like,
I don't know.
You probably do it for your own personal edification and to remember that you were there that night, even if the bosses didn't want something for social.
I've never really taken pictures of people. It's never been my thing. I've taken pictures of like a scene, a mountain view, or like weird graffiti art or something.
What is this if not a view of a mountain?
A moving mountain. Yeah, you're right. I mean, clearly the tallest person I've ever seen in Madison Square Garden. I'll tell you that. I've seen Victor now three times in terms of like on the court live, if you want to count Summer League. The G League Ignite Showcase in October last year. It's crazy. That was over a year ago now against Scoot Henderson back when they were wee butt prospects and not franchise faces.
This I know one, you didn't mean butt prospects, but it sounds it's fun to be like they were not very good prospects. They were butt prospects, actually. But like now they've grown into real NBA players and they're not butt yet.
I mean, you could say that with Scoot, to be honest.
Not well, it's early. It's really, really early. All right. So after your spectacle and after watching the tough times, what was your main takeaway from watching him out there?
That's what I'm getting to. The main takeaway really wasn't anything about like the basketball. It was how he handles the spotlight, which has kind of been my thing all along. I've been kind of more high on him from what's going on between the years than what he has physically and a talent standpoint, because like we've seen certain folks, Mitchell Robinson said, basically said, this dude's just KP from France. Like, I think I can handle him. And he did, to be fair to Mitchell Robinson.
Yeah.
He gave him that D train. Shout out Fred Katz. But I think it's different in that Victor Wembanyama has been highlighted and lauded, to use the exact word Greg Popovich used last night, for his entire adolescent existence. And I think it continues to be impressive how he handles all of the eyeballs.
Sure.
I mean, the league is thrusting this dude onto every single billboard, metaphorically and figuratively and literally, that they can, with LeBron approaching 40 and Steph. I mean, we're going to get to Steph later. Steph doesn't look anything older than 26. That dude is insane. I need to figure out what type of holy water he's drinking from before I
focus
turn 30.
Focus up, Wemby.
This
we'll
is
get
good
there.
Podcasting. We're just going here. Victor, last night, though, I saw the first crack of his composure. And even like that, he still like brought it back in. So like if a superhero's suit got like cut, but then, you know, it like fused itself back together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a really poor showing, still kind of similar to the opening night against, I totally forget who they've started their season against. I was trying to pull it out. I couldn't do it. But his opener, Dan can't either, for our listeners who aren't watching on YouTube, he's Googling.
If you want to like stop a second, we can go back and like just do it.
No, I think it doesn't matter. I think it's fine. Let's keep it going. He just
the Mavericks, John Gennaro, super producer John Gennaro, and Mavericks aficionado John Gennaro let us know that it was the Mavericks.
So that similar to his opening display where he started slow and had the flurry in the fourth. He didn't exactly have the flurry in the fourth, but like, and he said it post game and he was glugging a protein shake in between his answers, which I was like, man, I've never seen someone so skinny drinking so much protein.
That's why he's drinking it.
it's just so early. And I'm taken by how he is accepting that he is this living, breathing experiment that the Spurs are figuring out different tinctures and equations and don't even know where to put him on the court yet. And that was, I talked to a bunch of people at the coaching staff, like to see the, oh, holy, to keep saying the word holy, Spurs Mafia that, you know, I've won five championships, openly admitting that there's this puzzle in front of them that they're really excited to be working with, but they just like don't know what to do with these pieces, was interesting to see. And I am now like more entertained, I guess, and engaged at like watching the arc of his kind of career and life because of this like I hadn't seen really him with the Spurs yet, and like getting that dose of it while they get their asses kicked.
Sure.
I still walked away from that stadium being able to be like, huh, not just about the on-court stuff, but the whole entire apparatus.
If I can go to the on-court stuff for a minute, I do think, because you mentioned the puzzle piece and sort of figuring out where he even goes. That was one of the interesting things to me. And just like I'm catching up to the game this morning, Pop started out with him guarding RJ Barrett. And it's like, that's, you remember, like every night the lineups are going to mean he has to, he's probably going to do something weird defensively, because if you're starting a center next to him with Zach Collins, like that guy's going to guard the center probably.
I'll tell you, it looks weird too. It definitely doesn't look natural.
You have Jeremy Sochan at point guard, but he's going to guard the best point of attack or the best offensive player on the other side. So like he gets Brunson, you know, point guard to point guard. And then it's like, you don't necessarily want him to get muscled up by a bruising guy like Randall. So it's like, where is he? Is he going to be chasing Quentin Grimes around off ball screens? You probably don't want that, because you also want to try to keep him closer to the basket. And then he's going to sag off of a guy like RJ Barrett. If that guy makes five threes, you probably lose. You know, like that's the gamble that you're going to have to make. And then where you position him and who you move him around, how you sort of, what you can switch, what you can't switch, all that sort of stuff is like very much going to be a work in progress. He's already a major defensive force, but they're not a good defense yet. And part of it is like figuring out how to make those two things work together.
No, they're right now the worst defensive team in NBA history, I believe, per 100 possessions, which breaks the record that San Antonio set last year, as I noticed trying to work on a story about the Washington Wizards for later this week that are also terrible on defense. I think if you want to spin the looking glass to the Knicks side of this, I mean, if there's one team that's not going to be afraid of like that corner shooter with Wembanyama flying at them, or Jalen Brunson sizing him up and pulling up over Wemby's long outstanding reach, it's the Knicks. They are going to beat up any team that comes in front of them, and especially on their home floor with a delirious, definitely drunk crowd. And I never smelled the stronger scent of cannabis in MSG than I did last night. I'll tell you that. The scene was definitely, people were chanting overrated. They were booing Victor. It wasn't like when he first came out, I think there was definitely this collective, like, everyone was watching their own child walk for the first time, type of holding their breath. What's he going to do? And then when he airballed that shot, everyone booed him against Mitch on the left block. And it just immediately switched to like, this is a crowd that wants to watch a phenom die on the vine in front of them.
Right. Yeah. The moment of realization of like, oh, wait a second. That guy.
This guy sucks. And the only way New York, I mean, New York could do that, because in my ever evolving dialogue chronicling of the not so differences between Boston, Philly, and New York, Philly would say this guy sucks from the get-go. Boston would say this guy sucks from the get-go, then buy in, then say he sucks. New York would buy in and then say he sucks. Those are the three differences.
Right. These are your, you know, choose your weapon there. Either way, everybody's saying somebody sucks all the time, which is basically what life in the Northeast is. And it's why most of us are pretty miserable.
Exactly. The Knicks don't suck, though. They're the just Knicks, like, well,
but so that's interesting to me. Yeah, they are right now fine. Right. And they come out of this at 4-4. They've had some real like awful looking performances. They've had a couple that have looked really good. And they are like, it looks more like what you would have expected a Tom Thibodeau team to look like, where the defense has been really strong, the offense has been lagging behind, and then, which is like the flip of what it was last year, where the Knicks were randomly and seemingly by magic and illusions, a top two or three offense in the league. And so the question is like, how much of this is translatable and how much of this is real? And I think like, the defense seems pretty solid. You know, you adjust for pace, they're third in points allowed per 100 possessions behind just the Wolves and the Celtics, who like really good defenses. The offense per game, they've been like, because they play a slower pace, 107.1 points per game, really, really bad. But there's some cause for optimism on the offense. They've played, so Taylor Snar at his website, dunksandthrees.com, adjusts offensive rating and defensive rating for the strength of schedule you've played. So the Knicks have played like a really tough slate of defenses comparatively. If you adjust their offensive rating for that, they're about middle of the pack. They're 14th in the league in offensive adjusted offensive rating, despite the, you know, how sort of ugly it's looked early. A lot of the fundamentals of the offense are pretty good. Like they're still great on offensive rebounding. They're not turning the ball over a ton. I think they're 7th in turnover percentage. They're getting up a lot of threes. Brunson has been making his threes. RJ Barrett's been making his threes. If you get Randall and, you know, Emmanuel Quickly has had a really nice start. Some of their guys that have been ice cold, Randall's the biggest one, and he's the last couple of games picked it up. You get some of those guys to thaw out. And that's if it's at worst a league average offense and then a top five defense, you've got the recipe for another, you know, consistent good team with their style of just like, yeah, like it's a boxer that wants to get to the body and wants to just beat you up inside if they can find your range. It's not, it might not be pretty, and it might not be the kind of thing that can hold up against elite offenses every night. Like you kids can't score with as many of those offenses, but it's going to make them a tough out again.
I'm saying this as a transition, not to be aggregated. So last
night
I had the Celtics and Sixers up on my laptop while at the game. And you mentioned how great Quickly is. I was thinking, man, it would be pretty cool if Quickly was the like intermediary. We're not going all in for a star. We're just trading one or two picks for Philadelphia. I don't think the Knicks would do that.
That the Knicks didn't extend him is a really interesting thing, because I think if Quickly can his year unfolds the way that the beginning of it has and the way that much of last year did for him, I think the price point is going to be significantly higher in RFA or whatever the deal is next summer than it would have been agreeing to an extension early. But that's my guess. I don't know for sure about that.
I don't know how much higher, because I think. I don't want to say too much because I don't have all the details, but like, Sure. Let's just say something in like the 4 years, 80 million range, I think would have been feasible for his side of things. This side, like right now, I don't think he's going to have a Jalen Brunson type jump from there. Like what Brunson did in Dallas. I could be wrong. I mean, maybe something happens and he has an opportunity in the playoffs and, you know, injury, foul trouble, whatever, like who's to say, but
I'd say if the Knicks can get that price, I mean, well, obviously the rest of the season is going to remain, you know, more will be revealed after the way the season shakes out. But if the Knicks can get that number after the pretty solid number they got Barrett on, the steal they got Brunson, like that would be a very nice way to sort of solidify what they're building there. Obviously, everybody knows the thing that they're missing is like the bona fide number one star, the super, you know, like the guy that is the offensive engine that can take you over the top. The Alex Caruso type. I mean, listen, it's really hard to find a team that wouldn't be better with Alex Caruso on it, but not for that reason. Yes. But in the absence of that guy, and, you know, it doesn't seem like there's one of those available right now, and the ones that may be available might not necessarily fit for what the Knicks have. You know, you kind of have to figure out what your way to win is, and punch you in the mouth and grind out enough points is, you know, there are worse ways to do it.
So to Philadelphia and the Boston Celtics, the Sixers won 106-103. Every time the Sixers beat the Celtics, it's like, we have slayed this demon hanging over us. We have climbed the mountaintop. But it was a really good one. It was a really good win. I don't really have too much to say other than right now, my thought on Philly is that just like with the Quickly thing, I am growing more interested in the idea of the Sixers not trading all three picks and everything they got for some guy right now and doing a more mid-sized, can we just add a legitimate guy who's a starter who might be better than D'Anthony Melton, but might not be better than Tobias Harris, and just take this thing up a little bit more, and then we get more picks in the summer, blah, blah, blah. Because, like, they're pretty damn good with Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid, and they seem to, like, just really need one more creative type when Maxey's off the floor. That's kind of been the consistent criticism, like, constructive criticism, not poking. I mean, they're 6-1 and first in the East. You can't really be criticizing too much. So I'm curious what your takeaways were, Mr. Devine.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is that it wouldn't be a Sixers game if the celebration of slaying the beast didn't come with a terrifying almost, it almost went awry.
They didn't blow it.
They did, but yeah, they were up 15 with 3:45 to go, then gave up a 10-0 run and had to sweat out a Porzingis three at the buzzer that went, you know, went awry to survive. But they survived and they played the song, so that was
but
pretty
good.
But
what if this is the year? What if this is the year?
Shouts out to our friends Spike Eskin and Michael Levin at the Red Circuit Sanchez. You got to say the name. The stuff that stood out there, the interesting thing to me is what we saw last night, like what that sort of sets the table for in terms of a potential postseason matchup or games that you know, more consequence later in the season. Like the Celtics started this game with Drew Holiday guarding Joel Embiid. And it was like, whoa, okay, that is a weird thing to see.
RIP Marcus Smart.
But the argument and it's like, well, wait a second, why would they do that? I'm gonna get my Windhorse fingers out. Why would they do that? And one, if you have Derek White guarding Maxi, this allows you to switch that pick and roll to the Embiid Maxi pick and roll, so you're not giving up an advantage there. Two, it sort of goads Joel into saying, "I got a 6'4" guy on me. I'm gonna like just back his ass into the rim and put him in the stanchion." But that means like, I'm going to dribble from 20 feet away against Drew Holiday, which is a really bad idea and led to a bunch of turnovers early. Like Drew kind of forcing him into help Joel starting to create offense in space and then being put into traffic. Like that's not the best way for them to work. A lot of the free flowing offense that Philly's been working out the beginning part of the year with the dribble handoffs and the off ball cutting, a lot of that went away because it was like, well, no, we're hunt this mismatch. And so there was a little bit of like a Jedi mind trick to the offense. So what counters Philly would be, you know, sort of have for that in terms of the way they line things up and how Boston would have like a plan B after Philly adjusted to it in a playoff series. I'd be really interested to see what that all looked like. This is the biggest Philly team, like biggest, like size and length since the Jimmy team, right? Like you think about now, I understood why everybody focused primarily on the picks in the Clippers deal and said like, well, that what matters is what the Sixers do from here with these new assets.
Now you really are sounding like a Rights to Ricky Sanchez episode.
Well, but when I saw it, I was like, wait, they got Batum and they got Robert Covington to add to, they already have Tobias Harris and they have Kelly Oubre. Like now there's just a lot of big 3-4 types that can defend multiple positions, that are long, that are active defensively, and that can shoot. Like that is not a kind of roster that the Sixers have had in a very long time. They've very rarely had a lot. So, and you could see it, and like D'Anthony Melton being really long for a shorter defender. Like there's the only, and then obviously Embiid Paul Reed, B-ball Paul at the five spot. Like there's just so many big friggin' dudes and so much length on that when they play defense, it made it really, really hard for the Celtics to consistently find good looks. It was a really quiet Jason Tatum performance. I mean, the numbers wound up fine. I think it was like 16, 15 and 6 or something like that. Like, but in terms of him imposing his will offensively, really wasn't able to get much going. Derek White felt like he played better than the stat line looked, but still, I think it was like 6 of 18. The length that Philly brings to bear on defense, I think, is going to be a real problem for a lot of teams to deal with. And the X factor for the Celtics in that is Porzingis. The way that they can go five out with him and what that makes Embiid have to do, or the way it jumbles the matchups so that you can keep Embiid closer to the rim and somebody else has to go out to get Porzingis. It's a really tough cover when everybody else can shoot too, but Embiid looks really comfortable defensively or when he has the ball, like trying to just like mash Porzingis into the paint. He looked more comfortable against Al Horford than I'd seen him in a really long time. Like it should be a matchup now where Embiid can dominate offensively. And then the question is like, can Boston put him out of the comfort zone enough defensively and get enough offense out of Porzingis to counteract that? So there, it's too, like, I came away from that game thinking like this would be a phenomenal series again if we get there, and it'll be, I think, the fundamentals of it will look very different because of the moves that each team has made since the last time they matched up. It was friggin' awesome. It was a really, really good early season game.
I see a bunch of words in here from our producer, John Gennaro, saying everything is down for Jaylen Brown. per 36, less points, less assists, less break. Why are people so hard on Jaylen Brown? People need to give this guy a break. He's fucking good. I mean, he denied Tyrese Maxey and hit a clutch three where, yeah, I saw Porzingis cutting around the baseline and maybe he could have flung that. But like, he drilled that shot. He's good. He's a top 25 whatever player in the league. People, the left-hand video that went viral earlier in the... This dude is... Every team would want Jaylen Brown on their team. If he became available, that'd be like the biggest sweepstakes domino thing since whatever. Like, come on.
I mean, like, since like last week, we had, you know, like...
That's what I'm saying.
Remember, like, James Harden and Damian Lillard just got traded.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, he'd be one of those type of, you know, Drew Holiday is suddenly on the block. 15 teams are calling like that.
Yeah.
This is definitely a stump tweet at John, but everyone else who... I'm not saying I love Jaylen Brown and I want to build a team around him, but like, come on, this guy's good. Relax.
Yeah. I mean, this is a that's what the money is for type situation, right? As soon as somebody gets paid the largest contract in the history of the sport, even when you add in all the qualifiers in the context of that, people are going to be like, but okay, then shoot better than 40% from the field, be able to dribble with your left hand, whatever. Like, people are going to start doing all that carping. You know, this guy hasn't, you know, yes, they got to the finals and he kind of buckled at different points in that series, but he was also at some points the best player on the team in that series, like, yada yada yada.
You know who's buckled in the finals? Like, literally so many people. LeBron in right. Miami, Steph in game 7 against Cleveland. Like, I mean, these guys were 24 playing against one of the greatest players of all time, one of the greatest dynasties in history, and we're up 2-1. Like, I don't know.
It's totally fair. I think, yeah, he is. Some of it is also probably a knee jerk reaction to the Boston media mafia, as many Philly folks like to call it, where it's like there are a large number of Celtics adjacent people or fans or former Celtics writers or whatever. Shouts out to our guy Ben Rohrbach, who are at national platforms and who talk about the Celtics a lot. And so, like, when some people are like, that guy's great, then there's a backlash of that guy sucks. And so sometimes that happens. Also the contract, also the fact that, yeah, he hasn't been off to as good of a start this season. But the question of, like, is he still figuring out where he fits in the ecosystem of a new offense where you remove Marcus Smart, you add in Drew Holiday.
Probably they played 8 games.
Kristaps Porzingis. Yeah, for sure. And he has, his role is adjusted a little bit. The tracking data through NBA.com, he's getting about 13 fewer touches a game so far. And that might not sound like a ton, but it's a pretty sizable amount. And he's still figuring out where his shots are coming from. Right now, career low share of shots at the basket and finishing a career low share of those. So, like, some, you expect a player who, like, regularly shoots 70% at the rim or high 60s% at the rim, that'll normalize. You'd expect that as they get more reps together, they'll figure out how to get him into his spots a little more comfortably. And then maybe those numbers will tick up. But big headline for the Celtics, though, is the offense is, like, incredible so far. It's if not the number one in the league, number then number two, depending on what metric you look at. But they are getting what they wanted out of Porzingis being there and having that five out look. So the question is, like, does reorienting a little bit of the usage and the touches away from Jaylen and toward other players, does that make for a healthier overall offense? And if so, is he cool with that? Like, is he going to have any issue with that if his numbers go down a little bit, but they're a meat grinder? Maybe he's completely fine with that, especially considering that's what the money is for.
That's what the money is for. Okay. Well, speaking of money, the end-season tournament. No, we're not talking about the end-season tournament anymore. The playoff picture was going to be crammed in the Western Conference no matter what. And there were going to be a couple of teams who either performed very well last season or generally had high expectations that were going to come out the gate a little bit shorter, less potent than they would have expected in the standings. I'm pulling them up on my phone to not mess up my camera. So we could talk about a couple teams that might be interested in maybe pressing the panic button. First one that would come to mind would be the injury riddled New Orleans Pelicans, who are 4-4, but like a lot of scary long-term potential issues going on there. There was one team that I would be looking at to potentially make like an early season-y trade. That'd be my look. But we want to talk right now about who should be panicking more, the Kings or the King? LeBron and the Lakers. I'm curious which side you want to take, Dan, because to me, this was a quick one for me. I think this was not too difficult for me to answer who I'd rather be a part of or be rooting for at this point.
Well, then if it was sort of an easy and quick one for you, let me hear it. So if you had to pick one, like who would you rather be right now? You know, whatever, 8 games into the season, the Kings or the Lakers? You said it was a pretty quick call for you.
Yeah. One of these teams has young people.
Okay, so you're lighting the beam on this one then.
I'm lighting the beam. I think they were the 3 seed last year, which some people could look at as a fluke. But for a team that very recently was able to defy expectations and get up night after night in the regular season versus a team that kind of snuck their way into the playoffs after a really tough start and found some momentum and a midseason trade kind of plugged in a lot of holes for a while. Kind of like the Miami Heat on the other side of the bracket, where was this really a team that made the finals or was this a team that had negative point differential, all type of stuff. I think Sacramento also, like, losing De'Aaron Fox.
Yeah, there's the big one.
He's not out for the year. He's not, I don't think he's going to be out of the equation for, I think he's an easy piece to plug back in and he's going to have his burst, and he is not Anthony Davis riddled by a very strangely worded injury in his groin. And I don't know. I still think there's also like more of a, if we want to go on a vibesy side of it and not a data side of it, like the Kings are still building something, like from top of the organization on down to, you know, like small things like Jordy Fernandez being one of the rising coaching candidates of last summer. And he has and a lot of guys want to get paid and on the roster, and, you know, also just like continue to establish a winning culture and build something here. Like, I don't know. I think the Kings seem to be in just less of a panicky standpoint. Like, they're 3-4. They just had a tough nail biter against Portland in the Murray Brothers Bowl, but the shots aren't falling. Like, they're 24th in 3-point percentage. Sabonis and Murray have kind of regressed down, where I think that's kind of what we talked about. I think I said this in the most interesting players of the season pod we did, that Keegan Murray is kind of a swing piece of this team taking the next leap. Well, no wonder they're not taking a leap if his production hasn't improved. It's actually kind of regressed a little bit. So, it's also still early, like we talked about with Jaylen Brown figuring things out in Boston's offense. They're figuring this out without, part of the Kings thing last year was they had some of the best injury luck we've seen. And now they've been dealt a pretty crushing blow with Fox, and they're still kind of just figuring out a life without him right now. I think that ultimately maybe this will end the Davion Mitchell as the backup point guard experiment, where the Kings took him 9th after taking Tyree. Like, maybe that's a repercussion of all this. I saw some Kings folks on Twitter kind of, also saw someone randomly like throw Josh Giddey under the bus in Oklahoma City last night on Twitter. But Davion Mitchell has a lot lower stakes, I think. He's not the guy, but he's a lottery pick that we took and had high expectations for that we would be thinking about parting with. Again, I'm not saying that about either of these teams. This is just me pontificating to Dan Devine on a microphone. But that's the one like thing I'd be concerned about. Like, the Denver situation that we talked about at the top of this with Jamal Murray, like, will his absence show reinforcements the Nuggets need to get? Like, that's the one thought I have. It is interesting now that I'm speaking this out loud and just thinking there seems to, that might be a position, a hot position on the trade market that like not Drew Holiday, but maybe a tier below, like a secondary ball handler? Is he a sixth man? Is he more than a backup point guard? You know, like, you've got Tyus Jones in Washington, who I would think would be available. Malcolm Brogdon's name. Maybe Philly's a buyer in that position. Maybe Sacramento's a buyer in this position. This is just me spitballing off the top of my head. That's really all I would be concerned about for Sacramento to bring this back to task. I think the Lakers' issues are a little bit more scary to me.
Yeah, the Kings are a Klay Thompson buzzer beater away from being 3-1 before the road trip. And yeah, I mean, it looks ugly because they got smacked around back to back by the Rockets. But A, as we said earlier, the Rockets might actually be like halfway decent, and B, you're playing without your best guy, the, you know, fulcrum and focal point of your offense, an all NBA guard. So yeah, you'll get him back. Trey Lyles missed a couple of games too. Is there a rotation piece for them? I wouldn't be too worried about them figuring out. But for the sake of embracing debate, let me make the argument for the Lakers here.
That's what we do here.
That's right.
Balls don't lie.
A classic scream at one another fest, you know, much like you can find nowhere else. So yeah, the tail of the tape on the Lakers is not great. 3-5, 12th place in the West. You've already got Anthony Davis missing time with injuries. Stop me if you've heard this one before. The Lakers are, according to Cleaning the Glasses numbers, 26th on offense, 17th on defense, getting outscored by about 5 points per 100 possessions, which is not what you want and where you want to be. When AD is healthy, he's been on the court a ton because you kind of can't take him off of it. 37 minutes a game. AD playing a ton of minutes is one thing. The bigger focus has obviously been on LeBron playing a ton of minutes, because we started the season with he's going to play 28 to 30 minutes a game. And then that immediately went by the wayside. He's playing about 35 minutes a game. Neither one of those guys has played a full season for a number of years. And so if you're burning their calories early, you're getting heavy minutes loads on them early, is that going to come back to hurt you down the road? The optimistic case here is, remember that we just saw them make the Western Conference Finals because they actually did have those guys healthy when it mattered. And when they have those guys on the floor together, they're pretty awesome. So far this season, plus 9.1 points per 100 with an elite defense when they've got LeBron and AD on the floor. The bigger issue to me after, in terms of their offense and the structure there, is we've had that question of who's their third guy. And when they made the big reorienting their team deal, all the trades to reorient the team last trade deadline, it was like, well, that'll be D'Angelo Russell. And that, you know, went how it went last season. All right, but not great. They re-sign him. They bring him back. Has not been super great this season. Our producer, John Gennaro, notes he's the number three in win shares for them this season, but like, fine, but not great. The guy that they expected to take that mantle this season was Austin Reeves. Played great the second half of last season. They re-up him. He goes and he plays for Team USA, and they're thinking, like, this is our guy. This is the guy who's going to be our number three option. Complimentary ball handler, yada, yada, yada. Rough start for him. Only shooting 27.8% from three, barely shooting 50% from two-point range, 4 assists to 2.6 turnovers per game. So, like, not getting the production they're hoping for out of him. And that's the swing thing, is the shooting. The Lakers are going to – they haven't been a great half-court offense since LeBron got there, basically, but they need to have enough shooting to create enough space for LeBron and AD to work. That was the idea behind getting D'Angelo Russell, is the idea behind getting Malik Beasley, behind elevating Austin Reeves, bringing in Gabe Vincent. The moves that they've made have been about adding shooting to that roster. And so far, no good. I think they're 29th in team three-point shooting, if not that low, certainly pretty low. And they are shooting 31% from three-point range as a team. You get Reeves warmed up, you get D'Lo warmed up, that offense starts to look a lot more potent. And then hopefully, in theory, that reduces the pressure on LeBron and Anthony Davis. It allows you to use them better, to, you know, more effectively to their strengths, as opposed to just asking them to shoulder such a gigantic load on both ends of the floor. And then you see the Lakers sort of look a little bit more like the picture they had on the box when they made all those moves at the trade deadline and free agency. So far, it hasn't looked quite like that, but long way to go. And I think the idea being, we know where we want to get to by April, And now it's about working out the kinks to get there and finding out if what we've seen in the early going from Christian Wood is worth, you know, worth buying into. If Cam Reddish is sort of ready to be more of a role player on the defensive end as he's looked in the early going. And if that doesn't work, all right, is it Max Christie? Is it Jalen Hood-Schifino? Who are the guys we're going to turn to there? But the glass half full case for the Lakers begins and ends with when you get LeBron and AD on the floor at the same time. There's not a whole lot of teams that have a whole lot for them. There are more that can give them problems now than there were in the bubble, but that's still their best bet. And when they've had that in the early going the season, it hasn't looked half bad.
Last little section here before we get out of your earbuds, which I've always wanted to call Takes from the Couch, but it is officially called Hot Jakes.
I have some takes. Goddamn right it is.
First one, after coming home from Wemby at MSG and needing to wind down, I did not wind down. I wound back up because Nuggets Warriors was in, I was told by my Apple TV push notification, an epic finish. So I tuned in and I want a Nuggets Warriors Western Conference Finals. Not that hot, not that spicy, but I think, you know, going into this year, I was thinking Denver Phoenix was the matchup I wanted to see. Well, we haven't seen Phoenix at all at full strength. And we haven't seen Denver Golden State at full strength either. So many guys were missing last night. No Draymond, no Jamal. Chris Paul still f***ing good, man. Like, it's crazy how small he is and how old he is, but he still hits that midi floater, you know, mid-range, fall away, anything over bigger guys. And Steph is insane, like as we talked about earlier. The one rebound he ripped away from KCP last night, sometime late in the fourth, there was a turnover. Clay got back to contest a layup, missed it, and Steph just came in and added really not nowhere, but out of like not a expected matchup, ripped that rock away, and that crazy three hit to almost tie it late. Yeah, I want this matchup. I want this matchup. What say you?
It would be fantastic. It's a real styles make fights for me, you know, and you saw it. We talked earlier about the Nuggets really like leaning on their size. It is Denver is looking to get to Jokic isolating somebody on the block and either putting them in the basket or drawing help to kick. Aaron Gordon like sealing somebody deep under the basket, you know, getting a mismatch on a guard and posting them up, hammering the offensive glass with Michael Porter Jr. Like they are so huge up front and they want to use that. We saw them do it to great effect in the finals. They were able to do that a lot against Golden State, which is a small team anyway, and then was without Draymond, and that you know made them so much smaller. But then Golden State are saying, like, we know you want to play Jokic at the level of the screen and the pick and roll. We're going to get him out into deep water with Steph. We're going to curl him off. We're going to either get him to the point where he's got to guard Steph in space, or we're going to pull him away from the rim, get the shots up, and then be able to go attack after that. We're going to be able to make plays in space. You trap on the pick and roll. We're going to get Looney and then obviously Draymond, if he's healthy, into the pocket where he can go 4-on-3, find cutters in the corner. Andrew Wiggins looked like a functional offensive player for the first time in a little while when he was able to make some of those backdoor cuts, you know, the screening actions that they get into that make guards make decisions, especially if Denver's going to have to lean on a lot of younger guys thinking and trying to pass off assignments on the defensive end can lead to disaster against really good offenses. You wound up with two teams that have very different ways of making, you know, sort of building the offense, but they can both run it like clockwork. It was beautiful to watch. And then, yeah, it comes down to like one or two shots late in the fourth quarter of games. You know, like all you can ask for is having gone back to back last night with, you know, you were on the Wemby Bowl. I was watching Celtics, Sixers, and then Nuggets Warriors. And it's like, it's about the best that the league's got to offer right now in terms like four of the five or six best teams in the league that can just punch you both ways. It was a pretty fascinating thing. I would be all down, all for a, you know, Western Conference Finals matchup or any series that has those two teams at full strength together. Let's get Jamal Murray healthy, get Draymond out there, and let's get the ball out.
It would also have some Aaron Gordon versus Dario Saric second unit matchups, which if you were a big fan of the drafts between 2013 and 2016, as I was, that would just be something to warm your heart. Something that didn't warm my heart was the news this week that the NBA is considering potentially changing the NBA draft to two nights. And just a couple quick thoughts. I think it would be fine, ultimately, for you and me, so from a selfish standpoint.
The hottest Jake of all, it'll be fine.
But the take is, I just give me my post-draft Friday where I can go to the float tank. Like, that is a sacred day for me. This is the take. And I have some follow-up reporting to say that I have been told it's not necessarily meaning that the draft would be Thursday and Friday, maybe it'd be Wednesday and Thursday. That would be way better than Thursday, Friday for your boy. Do not take my Friday after the draft. Like, truly, that is one of the best days of the year where I essentially throw my phone in the ocean or the East River, and then it all starts back up again the next day because free agency starts like in a blink of an eye. I don't really need like a second round where we're all back at Barclays and the TV thing is happening, and I don't think so many teams would really benefit from having all this more time. It would be a way to catch our breath and relax and like whatever, but there isn't so much business being done in the second round. It's a lot of like, okay, can we get this guy at this pick to take a two-way contract? And then once we get to like the 40s, it's teams trying to pin down guys on exhibit 10s and to try to sign them for their summer league team. That mad dash would be the thing that's safe. Like, everyone would get a lot more sleep and they wouldn't be up till 4 a.m. calling players from Eastern Kentucky State, not to be dismissive, to try to make sure that they have their rights locked up, you know? So I'm fine with it. Just give me my Friday. Give me my post-draft Friday. And if you take it away from me, I might die. I might combust.
First off, that's the most serious I've ever seen you be about anything. Like the malice in your eyes when you were like, do not take away my Friday float tank.
I need it. I need the post-draft Friday.
My main thought is if I have to write winners and losers of the second round of the draft, I have to do a second one of those. Yeah, I'm not gonna throw Jake's phone in the river. I'm gonna throw myself in the river. So if we can condense this, honestly, if we could auto sim this whole goddamn thing, that would be tremendous for me. The earlier it gets done, the better. I understand that, but like,
it's not mince words. I love the draft. Love it.
I know it's
my
great.
And
you know, Grady Dick gets to wear a suit, and everybody gets to open the lining of their coat and show you what thing they sewed in there, and a lot of people cry. I understand the value of it,
It is everything the regular season needs to be. You got the pageantry, you've got the silly, but you've got the serious and like truly franchise altering stakes happening all before your eyes while people are playing dress up and acting like it's prom night. It's great. There's nothing wrong with the draft.
All I'm saying,
I understand why you want more of it.
But you're saying it's everything the regular season should be without the basketball. Like that's the basketball is
to me, in that standpoint, like all this hard work and all the hours in the gym, and you seeing this, the emotion pouring out. I've made it to this level. I did it, man. All those late nights, all those early mornings. That's the basketball on display to me.
I respect that, and it is worth remembering that we are writing about people, not just about a sport.
I'm always remembering that.
That is fair. That is a good thing to say. But yeah, I don't know that it needs to span two nights. I understand everybody. We want to make everything into the NFL where it's like 12 months a year, 24 hours a day. I don't know that there's a level of interest to support that in this context. But listen, I could be wrong. We'll find out. I guess we'll find out. God damn it.
The last thing on the subject matter of relaxing. The NBA.
You know what, Jake? You need to relax. Because this one is not going to be a hot Jake. This one is going to be a hot Dan. John Gennaro, play the sound. Here is the thing, NBA and NBA officials. You need to fucking relax, all right? I'm sitting there, I'm watching games last night. I see Kristaps Porzingis get a tech for hanging on the rim. Kristaps Porzingis should be allowed to hang on the rim. A, you need to be able to hang on the rim sometimes to protect yourself. If there's a guy behind you, you don't want to sweat, you know, just let go and then have a catastrophic injury. And then two, also, if you just want to hang on the rim because it's cool, you just did a cool thing and you dunked a basketball. It's a cool thing. You should be allowed to do it. See, Kelly Oubre got a technical foul for asking for, you know, I think he even like smiled at the ref. I don't know. He did something. It wasn't like a demonstrative and bad thing. He gets a tech for that. Showing human emotion. We should be wanting more of that, NBA. Giannis Antetokounmpo, fast break dunk, awesome dunk, posterization dunk, mean mug, second technical foul, eject him from the game, the not even the ref that was right in front of it, a ref from the other side of the floor comes over and calls the tee and throws a two-time MVP out of the game for doing the cool thing we all love when that guy does. We can't have this, ladies and gentlemen. Our good friend Vincent Goodwill on Twitter, maybe you've heard of him, the host of The Good Word with Goodwill, says you can't tell players to embrace emotion during the regular season, which is the whole point of no one rest and an in-season tournament and yada, yada, yada. You can't tell them to embrace the emotion of the regular season and then do this. Maybe the ref didn't realize Giannis had a tech. Who knows? Who cares? You should be able to review this stuff, because guess what we don't want to see is the guy that everyone paid for leaving early because he had the temerity to woof after a big dunk. Everybody chill the fuck out and let the players play like people. They're not automatons. They're not robots. Let them play and let's actually get to enjoy watching them. That's my hot Dan. Jake,
yeah.
What say you?
I want players in the NBA to be able to act like players in the NFL doing touchdown celebrations at all times.
Yes.
This is not the '80s. We're not worried about melees. Give me some lip snarling and some Pat Bev barking and anything under the umbrella of that. I would like that to be a thing. I would like this to be as much of a drama and a WWE match as we can make it. Give me the DX crotch chops that we talked about last week.
Let Joel crotch chop. We'll grandfather that one in two. The crotch chop should not be a fine. You should make $35,000 for every crotch chop. And then the other
bonuses.
Thing is bonuses for crotch chopping.
For all these people, Jackie Moon.
And the other thing, I'm furiously angry. I don't know if you could hear this and see this from me, is that Giannis was teed up while doing, he didn't even get to finish his too small. He mean mugged and he started to walk away and he started to do the too small. You saw the hand move down toward the court and he didn't even get to finish the taunt. Let the guy get his money's worth if you're gonna chuck him. But also, again, this is exactly what we're looking for. Let it happen. Let us enjoy this. Let these people be people and let us be people enjoying them do it.
With that, I hope you enjoyed everything we did and the emotion we showed and the antics we displayed here on No Cap Room. Thanks to John Gennaro for doing all the things he does to make this show look and sound great. Follow us on the various social media platforms that are out there. I'm at Jake L. Fisher. That is at Your Man Divine. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. That would be great. We thank you for listening and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.